Yeah, we're looking, remember that the first nine chapters of Mishlei are one unit, and they are really a long Musar Shmos about seeking wisdom and looking for wisdom. The short proverbs that are like one or two sentence sayings, they are really the second third of the book that goes from Perek Yud to Perek Chaf Hei. So we're looking at now at Perek Ches. And I'm going to try really because unless you're very conversant in Hebrew, it's, you know, you're not necessarily going to get the beauty of the language. A lot of this, and this is unfortunate, but a lot of this is not so much the uniqueness of an idea, but it is the beauty that it is expressed. Now I know that aesthetics in Tanakh is totally ignored in the yeshiva world. There's absolutely no question about it. We're always asking, what's the difference between this and that and that? But you have to understand that one of the ways HaKadosh Baruch Hu expresses truth is by the beauty of language. And the Rishayim already say this. And it's not so much analytically that you have to give a distinct and significant difference. I know this sounds like totally the opposite of what you ever hear, but it happens to be true. And that is, sometimes the power of a message is conveyed through its language as opposed to analytically fine distinctions. Davening is the same way, by the way. You know, you could sit and you can daven, and you can daven Rosh Hashanah, and you could, you know, ask yourself, what's the difference between this word and that word and that word and that word? You know, and, you know, you could spend an hour of very intellectual analysis, but you're not talking to Hashem. And that's a real big problem. It's a big problem when we approach things with such analytic precision that we sometimes miss the whole message. You know, the Arizal said that the goal of davening, the Arizal developed Kabbalistically all sorts of intricate, complicated, amazingly deep meanings of tefillos. If you ever see a Kabbalistic sitter, you know, it might be in the first Baruch of Shmon Esrei, there may be 10 pages of meditations. And it's not just the amount of pages. I mean, we would read the first line, we wouldn't understand it. In other words, you know, 10 pages of, you know, in each word, you know, has so much. When the shofar is blown 100 times, each tekiah has a separate meditation. The truest, 9 toots, each toot has a separate thing to think about. So there's so much. But the Arizal said that the purpose of all of his kavanos was that he should pray to Hashem the way a baby cries for his mother. So we sometimes need a lot of sophistication just to get us back to the simple idea of turning to Hashem. And really, that is ultimately what tefillah is about. And certainly a book like Mishlei is a lot that way as well. But think about the meaning of our lives. So in that sense, when you're dealing with things that are so contingent on the language and structure of things, it's very, very difficult. In translation, you'll read a lot of Mishlei, and it'll be flat, frankly. It'll be like soda without the fizz. Be a good person, be nice to people, you know. I mean, there's no big deal. But number one, you look into Chazal, and you know, you see depths, but also even in the Hebrew language, the way things are set up, the structures are very, very beautiful. So I'm going to try. So because of this, it's very, very extremely difficult for the rhetorical portions to really be read without a good understanding of Hebrew. So I'm going to go fairly quickly over them, just showing you some highlights. If you look at Perek Ches, chapter 8, verse 1, so you see a reference that goes over and over and over again. And that is, there is something called Chachma. Now, Chachma we translate as wisdom, but it does not refer to knowledge, it does not refer to facts, it does not even refer to knowledge of Torah. Chachma refers to the wisdom within a human being that he knows what is the right thing to do and what is the wrong thing to do. So really, Chachma is the sense of morality that a person has because he understands what is right and what is wrong. Now, of course, we get that from Torah. We get that from Torah. But it's not the amount of Torah that you know, but it's the internalization of that Torah, so you have the wisdom of what is the good way to live your life and what is the bad way to live your life. And what will give you that? So that's a famous verse in Mishlei that we actually recite every morning when we wake up. Reishis Chachma Yiras Hashem. Right? You know that verse? Reishis Chachma, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. Now fear, by the way, doesn't mean I'm scared of God. Fear means reverence, awe, a desire to worship the Almighty. Now what does it mean the beginning of Yira is Chachma, or the beginning of Chachma is Yira? That means like this. If you have in your heart a desire to serve Hashem, then every time you learn Torah, you're going to ask yourself, what can I take out of this teaching to serve Hashem? So Memela, you will acquire a sophisticated Chachma, a knowledge of what is right and what is wrong, what pleases Hashem and what displeases Hashem. Because you're learning because you have Yiras. If, on the other hand, a person learns Torah without Yiras Hashem, it's still a good thing, because Torah can help you come to Yiras Hashem. But if you're learning without Yiras Hashem, then you're gathering information, but you're not processing it to see, how do I bring pleasure to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Right? That's what it is. So Reishis Chachma, the beginning of how you get Chachma, meaning, Chachma doesn't mean knowledge. Knowledge you can get in any way you learn. You can learn Torah in a university classroom, and you will know something from Torah. But if we understand that Chachma does not mean knowledge, but it means a sense, a deep sense of what is pleasing to Hashem and what is not pleasing to Hashem, you get that only when you have a predisposition of Yira. Because when you have a predisposition of Yira, so everything you learn, you're going to ask yourself, how do I take this? Now, this is a difficult thing. You know, let's say you guys are learning Gittin. I don't even have an answer to this here, exactly. So you're learning about divorcing a woman by throwing a get in her courtyard. Now, the question is, and again, it's intricate, and it's involved, and it's deep, and it's complex. And of course, when we learn that, we're learning Torah, which is the highest mitzvah. But it's a little more difficult, and again, I don't even say I have the answer to it, to ask ourselves, okay, what lessons do I take from this in terms of how to serve Hashem? Now the Ramban writes, there's a very famous letter that the Ramban wrote, maybe you've seen it, maybe you've read it, a lot of Siddurim have it. It's called Igeres HaRamban, the letter of the Ramban. Have you ever seen what you've seen?
Yeah,
seen
it? Yeah.
Yeah, an art scroll has a book on it.
I have to read it every day. I'm Moroccan. I have to get some anger.
That's right. Well. So this is a letter. When the Ramban came to the land of Israel, he was older. Remember, I mentioned Friday night, if you heard, that although it's interesting, the Ramban shita is that living in Israel is a mitzvah in the Torah. The Ramban counts it as a mitzvah, but he himself did not come to Israel until he was in his 70s. He was expelled from Spain because he won a debate against Christianity. They've even made a play out of this. It's called The Disputation. But be it as it may, from Eretz Yisrael, the Ramban wrote a letter to his son in Spain, who was also supposed to be a big Talmud Chacham, not as well known, because when you have a father like the Ramban, you get a little overshadowed. But he was also a great Talmud Chacham. And the Ramban writes about the importance of modesty, of humility, of not getting angry. And he tells his son to read this letter every week. For people who have bad tempers, every day might be good, like you say. No. But be it as it may. Well, he says that Hashem will bless the lessons, will answer your tefillos if you read the letter of the Ramban. The beautiful, beautiful letter. But in the letter, one of the things he says is that anything you learn in the Torah, you should then ask yourself when you get up from it, how can I apply this in actual practice? Now that doesn't mean if you're married, okay, I'm gonna go home, give my wife a jet, you know, throw it in the courtyard and see what, yeah, that wouldn't be what he means by that, obviously. But it's a little hard, and again, I don't even have the answer, we'd have to think about it, but it's a thought experiment for people to go through. But that's what it means, chachma. So chachma, it's very, very important. You know, Mishlei is called by Chazal, Sefer HaChachma. That's the rabbinic name for Mishlei, the book of wisdom. And wisdom here does not mean knowledge, that means a deep understanding of what is good in life and what is bad in life. Okay, so that's very important. And that comes from Yiras Hashem, because when you have Yiras Hashem, then everything you learn, you see it through the prism of what will bring you to serve Hashem in a better way. Okay, so it's an interesting thing. Now, here is where Chassidus took it to a certain direction that the Misnagid world did not take it so much. And that is, based on this idea that Torah should ultimately lead to give you a chachma of what's right and wrong, so what the Chassidic world sometimes did was, they began to allegorize passages of halacha. So for example, if it discussed the ox goring the cow, they would say the ox represents, you know, the Yetzer Hara, the cow represents Torah, whatever it is, and they would try to give symbolic meanings for things. Now, that did not take root, except for Agadata. Agadata, that is done. But in halachic discussions, in the world of the literature world, they very rarely, if ever, allegorize halachic discussions. They do it only in Agada. And the reason is because they felt it would be somewhat of a distraction, because if you start looking at the ox and the cow symbolically, you're not going to get into the halachic details of the technicalities. Because you'll say, well, why do I need to get into all these technicalities? You know, there's a basic spiritual meaning here. So in a sense, the Hasidic world, not everybody, but in some segments of the Hasidic world, they tried to turn everything into an overtly spiritual exercise. But in the literature world, it's a more difficult process, because you kind of take the halachic discussion as a halachic discussion, and then ask, what do you learn from it? As opposed to changing it around into a symbolic discussion. I know that was one of the early tainas against Chabad. That Chabad sometimes, this sounds like it to be a bad word. Of course, it's not a bad word. They would spiritualize halachic discussions. In the literature world, there was more of a sense that halachic discussions have to be understood as halachic discussions. You then ask, what are the spiritual meanings? But you know, you don't like take the Gemara and interpret it in a symbolic way. So that's the first thing. So the first bit of vocabulary to know is the meaning of chachma. Chachma. Not knowledge, and not even Torah knowledge, but chachma is a deep understanding of what is right and what is wrong that you get from Torah knowledge. But only when that Torah knowledge comes out of Yiras Hashem, Reishis Chachma, Yiras Hashem. Yeah.
So how long would you say it would take to master Mishle?
Well, you'll never master Mishle. We'll never master any part of Torah. But to know Mishle well?
Yeah.
I mean, on some level?
No, I agree.
Depends how much time you want to put into it. You know, I wouldn't tell you to learn Mishle the whole day, and you have other things you have to do. But I'll tell you, the truth of the matter is, to appreciate Mishle, you really have to read it many times. In the course of my share, I've been reading Mishle much more than I have ever done before, and I can see that sometimes you really have to read it 4, 5, 6 times to begin to really appreciate it. Yeah. So these are things you have to read, because the problem basically is that the first reading, it strikes you, well, the first reading, here's the problem, the first reading will strike you as superficial, and because it'll say, you know, be good, you know, like general, very general statements. So it's only when you read over and over again, you begin to see nuances and meanings. So,
something with alien, you can't understand.
That's correct, that's good. So yeah, you have to read things a lot of times, and sometimes, by the way, it is helpful, this is true in Tanakh generally, it is helpful to read the text many times without a lot of Mefarshim, because if you're looking at all the commentaries, you cannot keep it in your mind. Sometimes you need to get into the words themselves, read it again and again and again, and then it has a certain power over you.
That's what I do when I learn Shira Shiva. I learn the Mefarshim, and then after I just read the English.
That's correct. You have to read the words. We spend too little time on the actual words of the primary text. We spend too little time on the words of Chumash, too little time on the words of Mishnah, because we're always looking at some second or third or fourth level commentator.
So yeah,
go back to Hashem's words. These are Hashem's words, right?
Yeah.
Read Hashem's words, and they have a power to you. So that's the first thing. So the first term here is Chachma, very important term. Now, the second thing that's interesting is Chachma, throughout this part of Mishlei, is personified as a woman. She is a woman, Chachma, because she is alluring. She offers you something very beautiful. And in fact, you're going to see that one of the common literary motifs that Shlomo HaMelech uses is good woman, bad woman. As if it were, there's the woman who represents Chachma, who is calling you to learn and to grow and to serve Hashem. And then there's a woman that is like a prostitute who is appealing to your evil, base nature, trying to drag you away. And it's interesting because, again, what Shlomo HaMelech is doing is, he's taking, you know, the urges that people have. People have sexual urges. And he's showing that the same way people can be attracted sexually to good or bad, so too. There's a Yetzer Tov that attracts me to do the good in life, and there's the Yetzer Hara. And there's always going to be this struggle. In other words, it's as powerful as two women who are vying for your affections. And they're both very, very beautiful. Okay? So, now, one other point, a third point, though, in this metaphor, is that the woman who represents wisdom is very open about what she's telling you, because she has nothing to hide. There is no lying. There is no deception. She's offering you only something that is good, something that is blessed, something that will bring you success in life and closeness to Hashem. Masha Enke, when you're talking about the prostitute, right, in order for her to entice you, she has to be making all sorts of, number one, she does it in secret, right? She doesn't want people to see. There are things that she's hiding. She's not really telling you the whole story. And that means that the Yetzer Hara works by deception, and the Yetzer Tov works by honesty. Because if a person truly understood what Aveiros were about, you'd never do them, because rest assured that there will be no long-term gain in sin. That whatever benefit a person gets from a sin will be far, 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 far outweighed by the detriment. It has to be that way. Because if you can come out ahead by sinning, then why not sin? What's going to stop me? I mean, Hashem had to set up a world.
So how do you direct thoughts that are
that? Well, that's where Chachma comes in. When you have wisdom, you know, you don't fall into a trap. Just like a smart guy knows not to fall into certain traps. So this is where Chachma comes in. Chachma is what will save you from falling into the trap. And that's what this book is about. This book is about trying to build a sense of Chachma, to understand that you have to look at the long-range aspect of things. You can't look at the short range. You can't look at the fact, oh, if I give in, I'm going to have some pleasure. Yeah, that might be true. But in the long run, things are going to be a lot of worse. So let me tell you a famous vort from Blake Chassman, who was a great, great Balmusser, a great Mashmiach. If you remember, when Yaakov is struggling, right, the night before Yaakov meets with the angel of Esau, the night before he meets with Esau, so that whole night Yaakov is struggling with a man, a mysterious man, and they're wrestling all night. And according to Chazal, the mysterious man that Yaakov is wrestling with is none other than the guardian angel of Esau.
Is this a saga?
We'll see. That's one of the meanings. I'll get to it. So, in other words, before he meets Esav in the flesh, he has to wrestle with the spirit of Esav. And Chazal identified that spirit as the Yetzer Hara, that Yaakov has to conquer his own Yetzer Hara before he's able to vanquish Esav. Now, if you recall, they're wrestling all night, and only towards the morning Yaakov becomes victorious, but Yaakov is limping in the morning, right? That's because the angel struck him on the thigh, and the Sefer HaChinuch says that's a remez, that there will be a morning after the darkness of Galus, but we will be limping, we will be hurt during the Galus. There's no question that we'll be alive and we'll be blessed, but there'll be pain. So at some point towards the end of the struggle, as the dawn is breaking, Yaakov asks the angel, what is your name? And the angel says, Lama zeh tishal l'shmi, why are you asking my name? Rashi explains that a name of an angel means, what's the angel's job? So the angel says, I have many jobs. God gives me different jobs. I have different names. So according to Rashi, Yaakov wants to know the angel's name, and the angel says, I don't have a set name. But Rav Leib Chassman wants to learn that this is the angel's name. Yaakov asks the question, what is your name? Answer, my name is, don't ask my name.
Really?
That's a name. Those of you who may remember a very famous...
How would that be in Hebrew?
Lama zeh tishal l'shmi, in the Chumash. Well, don't ask my name.
He's a Rishon or he's an Achron?
He's an Achron. He's someone from...
Can you argue or Rashi?
On these things you can argue with anybody. I mean, you're free to offer. Everyone is free to offer. You are free to argue with Rashi. You're free to offer a thought. A thought, just in terms of understanding something. Now, those of you who might remember a very famous Abbott and Costello skit, Who's on First? Yeah, Who's on First, right? So I ask you, who's on first? And you say, what? Now, then basically, who is a person? Right? And then they were so confused. So the same thing. What's your name? Don't ask my name. What's your name? I told you, don't ask my name. Why can't I ask your name? I'm telling you, don't ask my name. Meaning, don't ask my name is my name.
That's his name, yeah.
What type of name is don't ask my name? So Rav Leib Chassman says, gave a mashal, very beautiful mashal. There was a Polish farmer who came to the big city for the first time, came to Warsaw, and he was really amazed. He saw buildings, he saw cars, he saw different things. And he was told that if he pays money and he goes into this building, which was a movie theater, he would see animals and people coming out of a solid wall. A movie screen, in other words. So they were describing it as if there would be actual people coming out of the wall. So he pays his money, he walks into, he sits into a dark room, the room is all dark. And then all of a sudden, he sees animals and people coming out of the wall, but a moment ago when he walked by, it was a solid wall. There was no door there. How did they get in? He didn't realize it was a movie. He never saw a movie. So he took out his big flashlight to shine a big light on the wall to see if there's a hidden door. But of course, what happens when you shine a flashlight in a dark room on a movie screen? You don't see anything. So people yelled at him and they said, shut off your light. We can only see things when we sit in the dark. When the light is turned on, we don't see anything. What Leib Chassman wants to say, this is a mashal for Olam Hazeh. When you sit in the dark, you don't think about life. You sit in the dark. What happens? Things that aren't real, like those images on the wall, become very real. How much money I make, my power, my wealth. And what about the things that are real? You could have $1 million right next to you. You wouldn't even notice it. So when you sit in the dark, you don't see the things that matter. And the things that don't matter seem to be real when they're really not real. But when you turn on the lights, the things that aren't real disappear. And the things that are real, you see. Turning on the lights is a symbol for thinking about Hashem, Torah, and mitzvot. That when we're far away from Torah and mitzvot, we don't think about life, then the attractions of the Eitz HaRa seem to be so powerful, so good. But if you just turn on the lights, it vanishes. So Rav Leib Chassman says, going back to Yaakov, when Yaakov asks the Eitz HaRa, what's your name? He's really asking the Eitz HaRa, what is the source of your power over people? How do you trick people? How do you trip people up? And the angel's answer is, because nobody asks who I really am. People don't turn on the lights. They don't think about the fact that I'm offering them nothing, that I'm giving them the just love. I mean, I knew somebody, I mean, he was a friend of mine, unfortunately.
Unfortunate?
No, unfortunate, because this story is not a pleasant story. An older person. And somehow he got enamored with his non-Jewish secretary at work. Just enamored. He fell hopelessly in love. He was having an affair. He was married to a Jewish woman with children. And, you know, finally he divorced his wife, gave his wife a gift, so he could pursue this love interest. And people talked to him, a million people talked to him. He was insane. You know, people get insane about these things. He was insane. The day after he gave a get to his wife, whom he loved, his girlfriend dropped him. Day after, meaning as long as he was having an affair, sure, it's a lot of fun. As soon as he takes the decision to be able to marry her, he's like, oh, thank you. I really didn't want to marry him.
It was a sign that he's completely crazy.
Yeah. So this is and of course, he's a Cohen, by the way, so once he gives his wife a get, he cannot marry her again.
She does.
Say again? I don't know if she wanted to stay married anyway, but this is the idea of craziness. We go crazy. Now, Baruch Hashem, most of us don't go crazy in that particular extreme. That's a pretty extreme case. But every time, you know, we lose our temper because we get offended by something or whatever. We say Lashon Hara, we say things that hurt somebody. Because a moment of anger, I needed to release myself.
Right. Better when you talk bad about people.
Yeah, but you feel better for around 20 seconds.
Yeah, but
then you feel a lot worse.
I'm not saying that I don't do it.
Yeah, no, we all do it. Well, I'm not here to put myself on a pedestal.
Yeah.
But all I'm saying is that this is the idea that we get fooled. We get fooled by this. We think it's a good deal. We think it'll give us something. It'll give us happiness. It'll give us fulfillment. Then it gets exposed as nothing. So the constant theme here is that wisdom is like the woman that beckons you for a home, for marriage, right? That's a marriage, you know, stability, permanence. And the other one is also a woman, the prostitute, that beckons you for pleasure, for enjoyment, for secrecy. And then it turns out that everything is an illusion, everything is fake, nothing lasted. Okay, so Shlomo HaMelech uses over and over again the idea of the two women, the good woman, the bad woman. And of course, he uses this dichotomy. Well, the truth of the matter is, in Mishlei, there's always a double meaning. I mean, number one, he is talking about women in a literal sense. How many people know their lives get destroyed with the good, bad woman versus the good woman? But figuratively, it is referring to this struggle between what is called Chachma and what is called Kesil, foolishness. Because this is a constant struggle that we have. Huh?
Kesil?
Kesil is foolish, a fool. Kesil is a fool. Right? Chachma versus Kesil are personified as the two wives. And in fact, there are two verses about our wives that Shlomo himself uses. One is Matzah Isha Matzah Tov. If a person finds a wife, he finds goodness. There's another verse. Umotza ani marmi maves esa isha hara. Uses the same verb. I find the bad wife more bitter than death. So one says motza, he who found. One says motza, present, he finds. So the Gemara says that the minhag was in Eretz Yisrael. Whenever somebody got married, they would ask him at the wedding, did you get a motza or did you get a motza? What's the pshat? Because this was a little bit of a hint. There are two psukim. The good wife is Motza Isha Motza Tov. The bad wife is Motza Nimar Nimavas. So they would ask him, did you get a good one or a bad one? Now that's a very strange question, by the way. Because at the wedding, you're asking, you know, ask him a year from now.
It was for real? They used
to do for real? They would offer to the chassan.
They still do?
No, they don't do it today. But,
when was it?
Well, in the time of the Gemara, they recorded it.
Okay.
Yeah. Matzah. But the Vilna Gaon says a very important thought. The Vilna Gaon says they're really telling the man, it's a message to the man, that it's your choice. The way you treat your wife, you will either get a good wife or a bad wife. Meaning, it's not so much asking what type of person is she, but it's telling the guy, remember, chassan, you can make your marriage a matzah, which is a good relationship, or a bad one, depending on how you treat your wife. So really, it's a mussar to the person to treat her in a good way. You know, you tell a story, just a joke, it's a bit of a foolish joke, although I think it makes a good point. There was a man who had come across a statement, I'm not sure where the statement is, I'm not familiar with it, but in a mussar sefer that says that if you have a bad wife that tortures you, you're guaranteed to get olam haba because you've got all of your gehenim in this world. So there was a frum boy who decided he wanted to marry the worst woman he could possibly have because he wanted to get all of his punishment in this world, so he'll get olam haba. So he said to the rabbi, I want you to find me somebody who's selfish and angry. So the rabbi said, are you crazy? He said, no. So the rabbi, see, the guy insisted. So eventually, they find him a shidduch. Nobody wanted to marry this girl. This girl was angry and bitter and yelling and screaming and argumentative. And the rabbi says, are you sure you want to marry her? He says, oh, yes, this is the one. This is the one. So they get married. And the day after the marriage, the woman is so sweet, she brings him breakfast in bed, and she makes meals for him, and she encourages his learning, and she's kind, and she never asks for anything. So, like, there's such a tzaddikus, a righteous woman. Everyone loves her. So, the chassan is very disturbed, because his deal was, you know, he wanted the worst woman in the world, so he could get olam haba. Now he's getting this wonderful wife. So he says to the wife, he says, you know, you're really a lovely person, but, you know, you are a little different than you used to be. So she says to him, if you think you're going to get olam haba from me, you got another thing coming. Meaning to say that even her niceness was designed to hurt him because she knew that this is what he was doing. Now, it's just a bit of a silly story, but the point of the story is this. The point of the story is that we have a tremendous amount of self-control. Even this woman, you know, if being nice would serve her purposes, she would be nice. She could be nice. Rav Sosa Lanter once remarked, it's a tremendous control of the human being, right? That she would never be nice because Hashem commanded it, but if it served her desire to hurt her husband, she would even be nice. Rav Sosa Lanter talked about this once, about how every human, you know, we think we can't control ourselves. But if we have to control ourselves, we really can. We really can if it's important enough to us. He talked about the fact that once there was a woman in Europe, in Vilna, who was selling apples from an apple cart. You know, poor woman, you're selling apples. And a bunch of boys came and they pushed over the cart and all the apples scattered. And she started screaming, right against that, I mean, she started screaming, her face was red, and anger, you know, she couldn't stop. All of a sudden, two customers came by, wanting an apple. She instantaneously, oh, what can I do for you? She instantaneously, this anger that was uncontrollable, all of a sudden, she switched on a dime. Because she had to, it was her business. So we saw Solange said, you see from here, that if something is really, really important enough to you, you control yourself. Elamai, if we don't do it for Hashem's commandments, it's because it's not quite as important to us.
Yes.
So we have a lot of, again, I'm talking to myself, I'm not going to give much to anybody. We have a lot of control over ourselves. We have a tremendous power over ourselves. We think not, right? We think not. We think the Eitzahara is too strong. We have to give in to whatever it is we want to do at any given moment in time. I think I mentioned last week the minhag in Kelim, the great yeshiva of Kelim, we saw Solander's Talmud, the altar of Kelim, was that after a fast, you know, you ate food with fish with bones in it, so you're forced to eat slowly. You got a package from home, you had to wait 24 hours. All of that was about the idea, I can control myself. I don't have to give in to every feeling that I have. You know, it's an interesting thing. We think that to be free means to give in to whatever urge I have. But that's not being free. An animal can give in to any urge it has. Freedom is the ability not to give into every urge that I have. Then I'm free, because I make the decisions. I control. I determine how I'm going to live my life. That's what Hashem did when He gave me free will. Okay? So, Perek, Ches, and Tes, therefore. Imagine the scene. He's setting up a visual, as a movie director would say. We have like two mountains, hills, and the hills are in front of a city, two towns. And you're simply a passerby who's walking on the road between the hills. And on one hill is the woman of wisdom calling you to turn to her. And on the other is the woman of foolishness and evil and prostitution who's calling you to turn to her. And you're simply in the middle. And you're walking through that mountain, or that mountain pass. And the question is, which way do you go? Do you go in this direction? Do you go in this direction? And that's a momentous decision. Now, Baruch Hashem, in Hashem's rachamim, this is the great gift of tshuva, even when you make the wrong decision, you can still correct it. Meaning to say, it's not like you only had one chance to make the decision. But nevertheless, every time we make that wrong decision, there's something that we've lost. We've lost something very, very important. And that is what the call is. Right? So that is what is being described. What is being described are the two women standing on the hill that are calling to me as I walk through where I should go.
So what is it that you lose?
Huh?
You lose that moment?
Well, you lose that moment because, in a sense, you can never make up. I mean, for example, if I, if I could have done mitzvos years ago and I didn't, so even though from now on I have a good relationship with Hashem, but those years cannot fully be made up. You know, there are lost opportunities, lost years. But also, what happens is this: you have to understand that your ability to do tshuva is not equal either, because the more enmeshed and the more addicted and the more involved you are in those patterns, you know, you will find yourself more and more difficulties in getting out of it, like anything else. So, yes, tshuva is always possible. But the person who thinks I can sin indefinitely and then I'll have tshuva will not always have that opportunity. Okay. Now then, so that's the first point. So the first point the woman is saying is, come to me, for with me there is wisdom. Then there's a beautiful discussion where the Torah itself, this is in Perek Ches Pasuk Yudalit 14, the Torah itself speaks in first person. It's not Hashem talking. It's the Torah speaks as a personification. And this is really the elaboration of the famous Maimer Chazal, that Hashem looked into the Torah and created the world. Like you've heard this, you know, that the Torah, the wisdom of the Torah, is the blueprint by which Hashem created the world. What does that mean exactly? What that means is, in a very deep way, that the Torah is not a reaction to the world. The world is a reaction to Torah. What does that mean? Let's take a mitzvah like honoring parents. We might think, well, there are parents in the world, and Hashem commands us to honor them, meaning there are parents, and the Torah is reacting to that phenomenon, to that reality. It's the other way around. When Hashem is making a world, He has to decide, should I make a world with parents or a world where everybody is just created out of the ground? Well, Hashem said, well, the Torah says you have to honor your parents, so I have to make parents because there's a Torah that says parents have to be honored. You see, it's the opposite idea. The world was created the way it was because of what it says in the Torah. The Torah predates even the creation of the universe. And therefore, the Torah says, to me belongs advice and wisdom. To me belong understanding. The Torah is talking. To me is Gevurah, the strength to conquer the Yetzer Hara. And those who love me, I will love. And those who seek me, they will find me. Okay? It's very unusual. Most of the time we talk about loving Hashem, but here the Torah speaks, as it were, if you love me, I will love you. Yes. Again, the woman speaking. If you look for me, you will find me. So how do you get Torah? How do you understand Torah? By loving it, by looking for it. And then she will be available to you. She will open herself up to you in all of these different ways. And then she, my fruit is better than the finest gold, etc. And look at Pasuk Chafalup, who's a very famous Pasuk. Lahanchil Ohavai Yesh. Lahanchil, to bequeath to those who love me, Yesh, something of substance. Biyotz Rosehem, and their treasure houses. Amale, I will fill with precious treasure. Now, the reason I say this is a famous pasuk is it happens to be in the very last Mishnah of Shas, right? The very like Shas are the six orders of the Mishnah, and the last order of the Mishnah is the Seder of Taharos, the laws of purity and impurity, and the last Maseches of Taharos deals with a very narrow area called Uktzin. Uktzin is simply the stems of fruits, meaning if a fruit becomes tameh, when does it include the stem, when does it not? But at the very end, not so much of Uktzin, but at the end of the whole Mishnah, there's a teaching of Chazal that says, Hashem will give to every tzaddik 310 spiritual worlds when that tzaddik dies, that he will be a shalet, a ruler, over 310 spiritual worlds. Shene Amar, as the Pasuk says, I will give those who love me yesh, substance. But what is the gematria of yesh? Take the gematria. Yud, Shin, 310. Right, so this is the Mishnah of Lahan Chela Oeva Yesh. But again, the idea is the Torah is speaking about the fact that the one who learns Torah with devotion and service to Hashem rules over the spiritual worlds. The spiritual worlds come to him. Yonasan ben Uziel, who was the great disciple of Hillel, the Gemara in Sukkah says Hillel had 80 students. Yonasan ben Uziel was the greatest of Hillel's students. Was he drank what? Well, the Gemara says he was going to write that, but he was stopped from doing so by a big earthquake. Yonas ben Uziel wrote the Aramaic Targum of the books of the Nevi'im. And he was going to write the Targum on the books of the Kesubim, including the book of Daniel, which gives us the Mashiach dates. But when he began to do so, there was a tremendous earthquake. Hashem did not allow him to reveal it. So the Gemara says in Sukkah that when Yonas ben Uziel would learn, a bird that would fly over his head would be burnt by the fire. What fire is that? The fire of angels, the spiritual worlds coming to hear his Torah. By the way, I think I may have mentioned this, you know, near Tzfat, there is a village, Amuka. I don't know if anyone lives there. Does anyone live in Amuka? Or is it just the burial ground of, I don't know if anyone lives there even, but it was an old village. And that is where Yonasan ben Uziel is buried. It's amazing, totally dark. The only lights you have are, if you go there at night, it's absolutely pitch, thick darkness. You're in a valley. You see a million stars. It's an amazing thing. We don't even realize. It always bothered me since, from the time I was a kid, Hashem promises Avram, your children will be like the stars of the heaven. Okay, go outside, Yerushalayim night, tell me how many stars you can see in the heaven. Maybe you'll see 10 stars if you have good eyesight. So I never understood, what does it mean, stars in the heaven? But you go to a deep valley, which is totally dark, you see millions of stars in the heaven. There really are millions of stars up there. Now you understand what Avraham Avinu saw. But Yonas ben Uziel was buried in Amuka, very, very isolated. And the Svarim HaKadoshim say that is a very excellent place to pray for a shidduch. that Yemesh ben Uziel helps people. You pray to Hashem, of course, but he's a tzaddik who can be a shaliach to help bring a bracha for a shidduch. Amuka is near Tzfat. Amuka.
That's why you will go outside of his cover and you could see all the stars to remind you that Hashem, just like Hashem is building all those families, all those neshamas.
That's a very good point.
There's room for one more.
That the stars of the heaven is a sign for the fertility of Am Yisrael. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Is that the reason?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe that's why he's in the valley. But it is amazing. I've never seen, I haven't been in a lot of deep places in the dark, but I've never seen as many stars.
I think it all depends just on city lighting.
No, it depends. If you
remove the city lighting, you'll see a lot of stars anywhere.
No, you're right. The stars are everywhere, but because of light pollution and everything else.
And if you install some like night lighting by his cave, you will not see some of the
stars.
You're
right. You're correct, which is maybe why they haven't done it. But it's very scary. You're taking the bus up there because first of all, it's flat. You know, you're going up hills, and there's no railings. You know. Yeah, they think every second you think the bus is going to fall off the mountain, Chatzar Shalom. But you're right. If they would put in the lighting, that would take away a very important.
Is it close to Tzfat or is it far?
No, it's near Tzfat. I would say it's there probably is a bus to Amuka. I don't know if anything else is there other than the kever, but it's near Tzfat, so it's 20 minutes from Tzfat. So whenever you go to Tzfat, you go to Meiron and then go to Amuka. Meiron, by the way, is also a wonderful place to visit in the off season. Like Balmer, you have a 500,000 people. But if you go to Meiron, let's say now, right now in Meiron there's probably 20 people at Rishon Meir Yochai's Kever, maybe 30 people. That's an average Motzei Shabbos. You can have a whole place almost for you to yourself. So it's very kedai to find a way to get to Meiron, but dafka not on Lag BaOmer. The joke they say is that Meiron is so crowded that even Rav Shimon Bar Yochai leaves Meiron and Lag BaOmer. He goes somewhere else. Yeah. All right. But the reason I'm bringing in Yonasan ben Uziel is this idea that the tzaddik controls the spiritual world greater than the angels. There's 310 worlds from Yesh. Yesh is 310. This is the Koach of the Torah, not just the Torah, but the Yiras Shamayim and the Madrega. Now it's interesting that
I heard from someone yesterday, I was speaking in someone's house, who said that if someone saw that it would dip 120 times, why would it be 310?
He would go 310 or 120, did you say?
120.
Well,
120. I know my rabbis.
You have a rabbi goes 310 times? Yeah, well, I would imagine 120 is connected more to this world because 120 are the years that Hashem gave as a maximum of a human being. So Olam Hazeh is more connected to 120. Olam Haba is connected to 310. Okay.
The maximum, what is it approximately?
Is what?
120 is the maximum, or it's approximately around that?
Well, there are people that were older, but 120 is considered to be the maximum.
No.
Yeah. Okay. And then it goes on. And
after Moshe.
Moshe was 120 also.
And after Moshe, the one who passed 120, right?
Well, it seems to be from the time of the flood, although the others were older. Avraham lived 175.
Yeah, after Moshe, the normal.
Well, it depends. Eov is 140 years. It's interesting, but and there were
Yeshivas,
Well, it's machlokes in the Gemara. There are many opinions he was real. Some opinions he was not real. But the truth of the matter is, there are exceptions to every rule because even in the time of the Gemara, there are some traditions that say Rabbi Yochanan in Amora lived 400 years. We don't know literal or not. Everybody says that.
But decided that one is the maximum.
Well, it seems to be in the Chumash when Hashem said, my spirit shall not be in man forever, his days shall be 120.
I see. Yeah. So you went away with
that. Seems to be a question. Yeah, but there are exceptions. Okay. And then it talks about the fact that the Torah existed, again, it describes the world, the Torah existed before the mountains, before the hills, before the oceans, that all of those things are less significant than the Torah. And again, imagine this. We look at the world and we want to explore, we want to travel, we want to get money, we want to build buildings. Right? We want to have power over this world. But the Torah is saying, I was here before any of that. I was here before the oceans. I was here before the stars. I was here before the sun and the moon. I was here before the tallest mountains. So they don't compare to what I was. I was with Hashem, the Torah says, before any of these things. And therefore none of those things are as worthwhile. And there's even an expression there, an amazing expression in Pasuk Lamed. I was God's plaything. I was his source of amusement. It says, if you look at Pasuk Lamed, Vayah etzlo amun. The Torah is talking there. The Torah is talking. And I was with God amun, like a child that he was nursing. Meaning I was like his little baby. Vayah shashu'im yom yom. I was his delight every day. Nisacheket lefronav b'chal eis. Playing, very strange metaphor to tell you. Misachetes, the image is a little baby that is playing in front of the parent, and the parent is laughing at the baby as the baby is playing. It's a very, very unusual picture. The Torah is saying, I was the source of God's delight and pleasure before there was a physical universe. Now it's hard for us to understand in what way did the Torah give God pleasure before there was a universe. I can understand Hashem gets pleasure when we learn the Torah. Hashem gets pleasure when we do the Torah. But here there's something very unusual that says God got pleasure in the Torah itself. Now maybe the image might be this. I'm just thinking out loud. Just like part of the joy, what is the joy that parents get in watching a baby? Well, what's the baby doing? Baby, you know, dirties its diaper, or the baby might not be doing something that's so great. But part of the joy in a baby is you see the potential of what might be when the baby grows up. You look at the baby and you see what it would be. So maybe the comparison of the Torah to a baby that's giving God joy is that the ultimate joy is when the Jews accept the Torah and they keep the Torah. But Hashem gets the joy in the baby Torah because of what it will be when Klal Yisrael accepts it. Right? That's kind of the image of the image of the baby. Now this notion, yeah.
Is it possible to say that the reason it's a baby because it wasn't desecrated? Like once it came into this world, it started the Chal Torah. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, it became a virus came into play. Because as a baby, baby don't have a virus, but adults do. So therefore, over there it was a baby, now it became an adult.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. In a sense, the baby is also pure, undefiled, undesecrated, not contaminated. So the Torah in heaven is that pure baby Torah. But now this is very interesting. Go back a little bit. Do you remember that this is why the angels didn't want to let Moshe get the Torah? That was exactly the point. At the time of Matan Torah, Moshe is up in the mountain. The angels don't want to give the Torah to Moshe because they say to Hashem, human beings, they're going to violate the Torah. They're going to break the Torah. They're going to desecrate the Torah. Keep it in heaven. And Moshe didn't know what to do. Moshe's frightened. The angels. And Hashem says to Moshe, hold on to my throne and you'll give them an answer. And Moshe's answer was, you're 100% correct, that once the Torah is given to man, even the Jewish people, it's going to be desecrated. But the angels don't need the Torah. The Torah says, don't kill. Who are you going to kill? Don't steal. Honor your father and mother. Meaning, the whole purpose of the Torah is to help us with our Yetzer Hara. So, in a sense, it's like a baby. In other words, as we talk, the mashal gets more and more powerful. On one hand, the baby is pure. The baby is undesecrated. The baby is not spoiled in any way. On the other hand, you can't just leave it as a baby because its ultimate purpose is to grow up. When it grows up, he'll be doing, bad things. But there's the potential for good things. So that's the same thing. In a sense, the angels are arguing with God, keep the Torah baby. Keep it in heaven as a baby. But that's not the purpose. Sometimes parents feel that way. Sometimes we like our children to be babies, you know. We don't want to have them grow up. So that's actually the debate here. So the Torah is like a baby Torah in heaven. And Hashem gets so much delight. But it ultimately has to come to earth. That's the goal. Now, this word shashu'im is a term for delight. That the Torah says, I was God's delight every day. He played with me. I was his child before there was a universe, before there was a Jewish people. Now, I want to point out, though, that David HaMelech uses the same word in terms of how we should feel towards the Torah. This is a very famous pasuk because it's a very famous Shlomo Kalbach Niggah. Lulei Sarascha Shashu'oi. Shashu'oi. If the Torah would not be my delight in life, Oz Avadati B'Anyi, I would be lost in my impoverishment. Without the Torah giving me joy, I would be destroyed by my tzaras. David HaMelech had a very difficult life. His own son wanted to kill him. Shaul tried to kill him. Without the Torah giving me joy. Right, you know this singing? That's the pasuk. Say again? Who? I didn't hear you.
David's son slept with his brother?
Yes, yes. David's son slept with his half-sister, yeah. Amnon and Tamar, that's correct. He committed incest with his half-sister, that's correct. But that wasn't the son that tried to kill him. That was Amnon, his one son. The son that tried to kill him was Avshalom.
Yeah.
In fact, it's interesting, you know, Avshalom has a kever, you know, Avshalom has a grave that is, you know where it is? If you go between the east wall, in back of the Kotel, and the Mount of Olives, there's a valley called the Kidron Valley. It's a very narrow valley, right? So in the Kidron Valley, there is a monument that Avshalom built for himself. I mean, some say it's from the Crusaders, really, but at least we don't have a plain marker for it. But it's called Yad Avshalom, the grave of Avshalom. Now, Avshalom was a Russian, so it wouldn't be a place that you would go to daven for. But it's there. But it says the great Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the great Rav Shiva Meir. So when people would go to the Kotel to daven, other places to daven, he would daven at the kever of Avshalom. Why are you davening at the kever of Avshalom? Because, do you know the story? Avshalom tried to kill David, but when David was able to come back to Yerushalayim, Avshalom escaped. And Avshalom had very long, beautiful hair. Right? Do you know the story? And his hair got tangled in the branches of a tree. And he was hung. You know, he didn't hang. In other words, he wasn't hung. In other words, he was suspended. And Yoav, the general of David, was able to spear him and kill him. Because Avshalom was stuck by his hair. He couldn't get out until Yoav killed him. Now, David HaMelech was very, very upset. Because David HaMelech did not tell his general to kill Avshalom. And David cried and sobbed and wept. David said seven times, Avshalom b'ni, Avshalom my son, Avshalom my son, seven times. And he said, Mi yite mosi tachtacha, if I could die instead of you. And the Gemara says, because David said seven times Avshalom was his son, he brought Avshalom up from the seven chambers of Gehenna. There are seven layers of hell. Avshalom was the deepest layer. And every time David brought him up, one at a time, till he got to Elam Haba. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, what does he think about when he goes to Avshalom's kever? He thinks about the unconditional love that a father has for a child. Even the child that tried to kill him. And the child did everything bad. And David said, I wish I died instead of you. And he brought it. Reb Chaim Shalevit says, he can now turn to Hashem and say, we are your children, Hashem. Yes, we rebel. Yes, we've done everything wrong. But look at what David did for Avshalom. And you do the same for us. So Reb Chaim Shalevit tells it was Gedavka in Avshalom's keter that he was able to really feel the love of a parent to a child. And then he could turn to Hashem and say, show us that same love. So David HaMelech said on this, the same verse that Hashem uses, or the Torah uses, that if the Torah would not be my delight, Lulei Tzoroscha Shashuoi, Oz Avadati Biyomdi, I would be destroyed in my sadness. Yeah.
How come people don't go there for Yom Kippur? It should be packed on Yom Kippur, because like, this is a beautiful reason to daven for Rachmanis.
It is a beautiful reason.
Have you been to Yom Kippur?
I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe.
How do you know that people
maybe
go
people
there?
Do. I don't know what people do. I'll see if I can find out something about it. I mean, I know Reb Chaim Shalevit's work, but the truth of the matter is, you know, it only makes sense if you really feel that way. If you're just doing it as a show, and you know, it doesn't.
It's like a.
Reb Chaim Shalevit was very unique this way. He was a great Rosh Hashiva, a very great Rosh Hashiva, but a person of tremendous feeling, also, tremendous emotional feeling, just a very, very unusual combination. A great, great person. Rav Perlman was close to him. Rav Chaim Shalevit was nifter a long time already. Rav Chaim Shalevit was nifter, I think like 1975, so it's been quite a few years. But Rav Perlman was close. He told me a story that once Rav Chaim Shalevit came late Friday afternoon to daven mincha b'yechidus. There was no minyan, whatever it is. And Rav Perlman happened to be in the Beit Medrash, and he was close enough. Rav Chaim Shalevit, toward the end of his life, had unfortunately a cancer in his tongue. So his tongue was very swollen, so he did not talk distinctly, but in order for him to daven, it had to be somewhat loud. So he just mentioned that Chaim Shmulevitz, when he said the bracha, Atachonen, asking Hashem for Torah knowledge, he said it so slowly, with so much kavanah, like it took 5 minutes just to say the bracha. But then he said, the rest of Shemona Esrei took like 20 seconds. He's not sure how fast he knew the rest of it. So Rav Chaim emphasized what was the most important thing for him. The most important thing was Torah knowledge. Everything else, all right, that's less important. But okay, but he was a great, great man. Okay. But this is the, but I think what you're coming out with is a good idea, that the notion of the Torah being Hashem's baby means God's ultimate joy was in the maturation of the Torah, but that has the risk of corruption. But when the Torah was pure, Hashem had a special joy in the purity of what that Torah was. Yeah.
Also, like Yaakov Avinu, he loved Binyamin. Binyamin, one of those people who never did a very good job.
Right.
And if he, Chas V'Shalom, would ever find out that Binyamin was dead, even by seeing that he didn't come back from after he went to Mizraim, that would by itself will cause him death. So it's also by looking at Binyamin, he looked at something that he didn't get from other
he would see the purity of the soul. Yeah, yeah. Svarim tell us, there are Bali Mutra that have actually said that until a child learns to speak, it's funny, even though any child below Bar Mitzvah doesn't sin, but until he learns to speak, the child has a Ruach HaKodesh. It's very, very amazing. In other words, let's say a newborn baby. You know, you don't know what's going through that mind there. But he knows all sorts of things. He has all sorts of Ruach HaKodesh. Once he learns to speak, he loses the practice. Because Hashem doesn't want him to be a prophet. But until he speaks, he has all sorts of wisdom. That's why sometimes it's, you look into a baby's eyes, there's something very, very unusual in the baby's eyes.
Person who has prophecy and doesn't say it, he's Chayav Nisa.
So that's correct. That's correct. But Hashem doesn't want the baby to give you a message. He doesn't want your 2-year-old to tell you, what's going to happen. But until he knows. Now, so there actually is a concept that until a child is verbal, there's a certain Ruach HaKodesh or Ruach Nevuah that the child has that is nistalik, that leaves as soon as he gets the power of speech. Okay.
Well, now, no, teach him how to speak.
Huh?
Well, if you're not Rikishin, let us speak.
Well, then it may stay with him, but on the other hand, he's not going to be able to tell you anything.
Write it down.
Yeah. You know, but that's crazy. You're supposed to teach your child how to speak because your child, you have to teach your child Torah, right? You're not allowed.
That's a long answer.
Yeah, yeah.
The Torah professor.
Now, by the way, there was an experiment. You know, King James of England, he is the guy who commissioned the translation of the Bible, the King James Bible. So King James had a theory that if you never taught a child how to talk, they would naturally know Hebrew, because Hebrew was the divine language. So he had a theory, if you locked up a kid and never spoke to him, he would know Hebrew. So story has it, he took like 12 kids. He locked them up in the Tower of London. He didn't allow anyone, no, he fed them, but he didn't allow anyone to talk to them. And he wanted to think that by 2 years old they would speak Hebrew, but it didn't work. And unfortunately, I think the way human beings are, if they're not exposed to speech in the first 2 years, like a deaf person gets better, it's very, very hard. They can never really speak normally again. You know, so whatever, that was a human experimentation in the days when it was permitted. Today, we, Baruch Hashem, we don't do those things. Okay. Now then it goes on with the wisdom. This is back in Perek Tes, and it says, wisdom builds her house with 7 strong pillars. A house that is standing on 7 pillars. What is the 7 pillars? So Rashi brings that the 7 pillars refer to the 7 chumashim of the Torah. You'll ask Akasha, 7 chumashim of the Torah? There are 5 chumashim of the Torah. So Rashi says, no, there's actually 7 chumashim, because the book of Bamidbar, number 4, which we finished today, is divided into 3 chumashim. So we have Bereshis, we have Shmos, we have Vayikra. Bamidbar is 3. I'll give you the division in a moment, that's 6. And Devarim is number 7, and the 7 chumashim mirror the 7 days of creation, that just as the spiritual Torah is 7, the physical world was made in 7. Now, what are the 3 divisions of the book of Bamidbar?
It's funny because the rabbi was giving a mashal today, and he was saying something very much like that. It says in the first pasuk of Maaseh,
And
so he was explaining how that this was actually 3 reasons why the Yisrael, one leaving from Mitzrayim and one leaving, then going to Eretz Yisrael.
So there's a reason for the leaving and a reason for the going.
Yeah, and then also a reason for being forced to go.
Right.
So it's 3 reasons, so it makes sense why it would be divided.
Okay. So in Bamidbar, it was a very, very unequal division. The first part of Bamidbar is 2.5 parshios. Parshios Bamidbar, Naso, and part of Balosa, which takes you up to the time that they're leaving Mount Sinai. And that describes the ideal world, the world of the Mishkan, the world of the camps, the world of the tribes. And then you have only 2 verses. The second book of Bamidbar are only 2 verses. A whole Chumash. 2 verses, and those are the verses we recite when we take out the Torah every Monday, Thursday, and Shabbat. Vayhi bin Soa Ha'aram, when the ark was traveling, Moshe Rabbeinu said, scatter all the enemies of the Jewish people. And then the next half of the next third of Bamidbar is the rest of the Sefer, which talks about all the Averos, Korach, the Meraglim, and the like. So the 3 sections are the ideal, is the first section. The third section is the reality. And the two verses are the transition. And that is when you leave Mount Sinai, then you fall into the deep, deep pit.
So it's like the beginning of, so to speak, the heathens on our own, is when it's like the beginning of the fall. It's not only the beginning of the fall, but the beginning of actually everything.
Well, yes, because that's our journey away from Har Sinai. Is exactly it. And in fact, it's interesting that in the Torah, the two verses, Vayhi b'Nisso Aharon, are set off by nuns, extra nuns. And nun represents nefila, falling down. But they're upside down nuns, or reverse nuns, as if to say that even though when you leave Mount Sinai, you're going to fall, you can reverse it, you can change it. Shuba.
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to go back to our Sinai, basically.
That's right. We're journeying away, but we hope to make it up a circle and come back. That's right. So this is why wisdom is called seven pillars. It is the seven pillars of the Torah. Now, we still commonly say five chumashim. That's the common way. If you said seven, somebody would look at you strangely. But in point of fact, Chazal see it as seven chumashim, because they divide Bamidbar into three. So it mentions wisdom builds its house with seven pillars. She slaughters the meat. She mixes the wine. Now here's a little bit of interesting grammar I'm going to share with you. The word for mixing wine. Now what is mixing? We don't mix our wine today because our wine is largely pre-mixed. But in the time of the Gemara, wine was very strong. And in order to be able to drink it, we would mix water with the wine, and that made it palatable. In fact, according to halacha, you can mix quite a lot of water with wine. You can mix up to six parts of water to one part of wine. But not in our wine. Our wine's already been watered down. But technically, six to one, you could still make borei pri agafen. Optimally, it's 3 to 1. But again, our wine's already mixed, so you can't add that much water to it. Now, what's interesting is the word for mixing wine is mascha. Mesach, mascha, is to mix wine. So it's interesting that Taisus Yatzif, which is one of the great commentaries on Mishnayos, says that that is the source of the word for a tractate, right? What is the term for a tractate of Mishnah or Gemara? We call it maseches, or in Aramaic, masechta. It's the same thing, right? So gittin, right? Or whatever is over there. Gittin, well, there's a difference. But the word before the name of the tractate is called maseches gittin. Tractate of gittin. Maseches bava mitzia, maseches bava kama, maseches brachos. Now, maseches means treatise or tractate. Those are the same thing. But in Hebrew, what is the sherish of it? So the Taisus Yom Tov says that just like the word masecha is to mix wine with water, or mix water with wine, so it becomes drinkable, palatable, digestible. So too, a maseches takes an area of halacha and it explains it and elaborates it so you're able to understand it and take it in. Which means a maseches is fine wine mixed with water that you're able to drink.
Maseches is diluted.
Yeah, diluted, but here's the problem. Dilution in English sounds like a bad thing. So we're not going to say Gemara is diluted, but we're saying it becomes palatable. Because the wine without the water is not drinkable. So the written Torah without the oral Torah, you don't understand it. So the same way you need the water to be able to drink the wine, you need the oral law, which is the water, to be able to drink and understand the written Torah, the Mishnah or the Chumash even. Okay? So diluted is not the good word to use here, because diluted would imply, you know, superficial. Here is the other way around. It makes it drinkable. Makes it digestible, it makes it absorbable. Otherwise, you would not understand the written Torah. Okay? That's why a tractate is called Maseches. It is based on this idea, Niska Yena, And again, this is actually talking about Torah. In fact, allegorically, that's what he even means. It says, the wise woman mixes her wine. Now, the woman is itself Torah, meaning the wine of Torah is mixed with the water of the Torah Shemalteh that makes it palatable and drinkable. And indeed, that's what the Vilna Gaon says, that the written Torah is called wine and the oral Torah is called water. And the mixing of the water and the wine makes the written Torah understandable, absorbable into my mind and my body. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. Wish you all the good.
Sure.
Good night.
Sure.